This is Connie Barlow, and this is an hour-long interview with Paul S. Martin, Pleistocene ecologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson. I taped this interview with Paul at his home in Tucson, Arizona in September 1999, right after he, myself, and the Earth System scientist Tyler Volk from New York University had just returned from a three-day fun field trip botanical excursion into Sonora, Mexico. In this interview, I touch on three main areas of Paul Martin's work as a Pleistocene ecologist. First, he talks about the early days and how he came to his overkill hypothesis. And in here, you'll hear him talking about such names as Ed Deavy, his experience with George Gaylord Simpson, and of Louis Leakey in Africa. At around the 37-minute mark, I shift the interview to what was then called bringing back thesis. And in the 1970s, Paul Martin advocated bring back camels for browsing control of creosote bush, and because the camel family, Camelidae, was actually native to North America and had gone extinct at the end of the Pleistocene. At about the 50-minute mark, we shift to Bring Back the Elephant, which was a paper that he published with Dave Burney in Wild Earth magazine. And then at minute 54, the rest of the interview concerns the idea of ghosts and ecological evolutionary anachronisms, based on a 1982 paper published in Science, where he was second author to the ecologist Dan Jansen, proposing this idea. Since this was 1999, I was at that point doing research for my book, The Ghosts of Evolution, which would ultimately be published by Basic Books in 2001. So here you hear Paul S. Martin, and the other male voice is Tyler Volk, and myself, Connie Barlow. Overkill. How did you come to that idea? Was it an instantaneous thing? Had it been building for a while?
It built for a while, I'm sure. And I'm sure I don't remember all the twists and turns. It probably started in New Haven at Yale when I was on a postdoc with Ed Deavy, the paleoecologist, who left me space in his old office when he was moving into a new office in Osborne Zoological Laboratories at New Haven. The office I moved into had some leftovers in it that Ed Deavy hadn't moved out. And among the leftovers was a jar of stones and fluid. And this seemed strange since Deavy was a biologist, limnologist, that he bothered to have a jar of stones and fluid inside his office. And I had to find out what they were, and the answer was they were Moa gizzard stones.
Wow.
And you look at them and they're nice and smooth. They've been in the gizzard, they've been grinding up the plant material or whatever it is the moas have been eating. And these are found in bogs in New Zealand, in places where you would never find stones.
Yes, so there's no doubt that it's a gizzard stone.
The lake sediments, low energy environment, and sand is not to be expected unless there was an unusual flood. But even an unusual flood in a low gradient, low energy environment wouldn't carry egg size or chicken egg size stones. Many of them aren't that large, but pigeon size eggs into a bog. And Deavy was publishing or had published an article in Scientific American about moas in New Zealand. He'd spent a sabbatical there studying the limnology and the paleolimnology of lakes in New Zealand, and there were issues of climate change in a country that hadn't had a whole lot of work done on Pleistocene climates yet, and this question, of course, of extinction of the moas. And Deavy was certainly entertaining the view that the moa extinction had been caused by people. And I thought everybody entertained that extinction. Only years later I began to look at some of the literature of paleontologists that have been working on the fossils of moas in New Zealand, and they were not at all disinclined in the 1940s anyway to claim that people were involved in the extinctions of New Zealand's moas. They were still looking for climatic explanations.
So Deevy was one of the few or the only one?
Deevy was one of the early ones who was disposed to think of this event as not explainable by climatic change, and he had his handle on climatic change through the paleolimnology work that he was doing in the lake sediments. He was the first person among the North American pollen analysts to deal with sediments that could be of the same age as the Upper Dryas or Younger Dryas in the Old World, where people had, paleobotanists had long recognized subarctic or arctic type plants in Denmark and other Scandinavian or Northern European countries that left a strong signal of vegetation change driven by climate. And in the New World, all the work that had been done with pollen had been in organic sediments, and they were radiocarbon dated, or being radiocarbon dated, as less than 10,000 years, so they weren't old enough to see what was going on in the New World until Deevy said, we've got to look at clays. We can't do this by looking at peats alone. The sediments that would be deposited in a subarctic environment in deglaciated parts of New England or unglaciated parts of Pennsylvania would not be organic. Although organic sediments are always rich in pollen, they'd be inorganic, and they're getting pollen out of that sort of stuff in Europe, and we've got to do that in the Americas too. So he succeeded in doing this with hydrofluoric acid and put together some of the first pollen evidence for a late glacial treeless or mix of trees and conifers, mix of conifers and herbs. That was the New World equivalent of the Younger Dryas.
And that was all in the East?
And that was all in the East.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in that time, it was only 8 months that I spent in New Haven. I was hanging out as much as I could with people who were doing Pleistocene ecology or geology. And the big gun was Richard Foster Flint, who was in an endowed chair. Position was terminated after Flint's retirement. They never had a Pleistocene geologist again at Yale, as far as I know. The geochemists took over after that. But Flint was doing a holistic approach to the Pleistocene, everything about it except maybe the ecology. And some of that was included in his textbook of Quaternary Geology. And that textbook tilted appreciably, if not totally, toward human involvement as the cause of extinctions, because he'd gone over all the phenomena that were explained by climate change, sea level changes, and ice advance and retreats, and faunal and floristic shifts. And from his point of view, as a powerhouse in Quaternary geology, the answer was going to be cultural and not physical. And that was a shocker, because usually people who study physical phenomena explain everything that way.
Right. Now, back then they already knew that there were at least four waves of glacials and interglacials.
Yes, they'd known that, and they were beginning to get some of the marine record that indicated that there were going to be more than four glacial and three interglacial. It was the lucky seven roll of the dice in those days. Everything could be explained by rolling seven. You'd have four glacials and three interglacials, and that would account for everything in the Quaternary. And this wonderful paradigm was about to fall apart. So there'd be far more cold periods and far more warm periods. And then, of course, it turned out in those days, the interglacials were viewed as taking long periods of time, hundreds of thousands of years anyway, to develop the soils that were supposed to require that amount of time. And if the soils were properly correlated to ice retreats, then an interglacial would occupy hundreds of thousands of years. Now we think it occupies 10,000 years or less, depending where you are in the marine record or the ice core record. So I got a dose of a strong whiff of something I hadn't gotten when I was a student at the University of Michigan, where everything was climate driven, of the sense that this Ivy League institution has got state-of-art science going, and the fields that I'm most interested in, and these people are at least friendly, if not partisan, to the idea that people are doing it. I should look at some data myself and see what comes of it. So I got another postdoc, since I hadn't found a job in the year that I had the first one, from Canada, from a former member of my graduate committee, Pierre Doncereau, at the University of Montreal in Quebec, Canada. And they preferred to pick candidates that had a similar faith to most French Canadians, that were Catholics and that could speak French and read it, and they were academically highly qualified. And I didn't make it on two or the three criteria, but they were in a hurry to fill the post, so I got the postdoc. Maybe I didn't fill it in any of the criteria. Anyway, I found myself with a family of two tiny boys in a farmhouse outside Montreal, because my partner, my wife, didn't want to live in the city, although Montreal's a pretty nice city.
Yeah.
So I had an hour to drive to and fro from the University of Montreal. And in the farmhouse, I could continue to do pollen counting. They let me take a microscope away from the university, and I didn't have to drive in and out. When the weather was bad, or pretty much at my own discretion, what I do, like postdocs are supposed to be treated, I thought. I still think it's wonderful. And I got bored with counting pollen in the middle of winter. And George Gaylord Simpson's checklist of mammals, living and extinct, Cenozoic mammals, the genera of Cenozoic mammals, I thought would provide a test to this idea that people could be involved in the extinctions at the end of the Quaternary. So I started to go through, for the Pleistocene, Pliocene, and Miocene, and I ignored the Oligocene and the Eocene, for fossils of the world, and added up the number of genera by orders, rodents and shrews and rabbits and big stuff, the artiodactyls and the perissodactyls, proboscidea. And the first thing I noticed was that all the animals that disappeared at the end of the Pleistocene were large, as you looked at the continents. But the people who were studying them from the point of view of evolution were starting at the bottom. I was starting at the top and working down. They were starting at the bottom and working up. And the interest that Simpson, the famous vertebrate paleontologist at that time, I think he was still at the American Museum in New York City, and he eventually moved to Tucson, and I could visit him here on occasion.
Oh, you actually met him?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I first met him when I was coming to Arizona. Yeah, I first came to Arizona in 1956, and he was in Las Lunas, New Mexico, where he went every summer. And my wife and I were driving out to the Chiricahuas with two small boys in tow. And I met him casually at the American Museum. He wasn't very personable, or at least he didn't seem
that. That's what I hear.
He was kind of standoffish. But I figured, I want to talk to this guy, so I hunted him down in Las Lunas. I don't even know where it is now. I wouldn't be able to find it. It's somewhere in northern New Mexico. I guess it's near a fossil locality.
I don't know.
Near a fossil locality.
Yeah.
That's why he was there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't doing much field work, but he liked it. Mm-hmm. And he and Ann Rowe, his spouse, told me how to get there, and we went in and visited a bit. I had some questions. I don't remember what they were now. but we bearded the guy in his lair in Las Lunas. And then later on he came to Tucson. He set up his library so visitors could come in and use it. He had a real top-notch reprint library, which he wanted to give to the University of Arizona, and the administration here wouldn't accept it. The cost of maintaining a departmental library, all departments will want one. If one department gets it, that's one problem.
Yeah.
And then you need somebody to be a librarian for it,
yeah.
And you need the space for it, and all the faculty members want more space for their offices, and you're giving it to the paleontologists only for it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
The University of Florida got it. Mm. When Dave Webb came up here and was on the advisory group that the CIMRO Foundation had to maintain its nonprofit status, and the library was part of that, and it ended up in Gainesville. Mm. A little tangent there. Mm. The front and center is reading Simpson's checklist. I think it's 1945 when it was published out of the American Museum as a bulletin. And I'm noticing that the extinctions at the end of the Pleistocene, I'm not surprised, are involving only large animals.
Are you the first one that kind of at least notices that enough to have put it in print somewhere?
Yeah, I think so.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
As about half of what I've leaned on ever since is based on what came out of Simpson's checklist and what I published in a chapter in Zoogeography in 1960 or 1959.
Whose book is that?
A AAAS published book edited by Carl Hobbs. And if I think of it, I may have a copy back and I can give you. Pleistocene Ecology, I think, was my chapter title. And half of it was on extinction by human impact.
Mm. You hadn't invented the term overkill then, yet?
Overkill came up, I think, when some of us were active with the Quakers in some peace demonstrations going into the war with Vietnam. And after one of these demonstrations, sitting around with a smart lawyer, it's always good to have a lawyer if you're going to be doing something political. Anyhow, the lawyer asked what I was doing, and I started to explain this, and he said, "Oh, you're studying overkill. You've been out there demonstrating against it. This is what you study."
Really? I mean, there was actually a term for it that was used in
Well,
human
overkill
sense?
Was being used as the aftermath of dropping the bomb.
Okay.
Neat.
Okay. Wow.
So I'll claim credit for the idea, but I think it was Ed Morgan. He was the attorney that we had at the time.
But what a year about would that have been?
Oh, when did the Vietnam?
65.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was shortly before Pleistocene extinctions, which was 67.
Yeah. So that would have been in process.
It was when the draft had started.
Yeah.
And there was picketing going on at draft boards and with Davis Monthan flying SAC bombers out of Davis-Monthan. We were all in Tucson, part of the process, and we'd already been campaigning against the Titanizing of Tucson. It was called the location of Titan silos around the city. And one of the atmospheric physicists led the charge on educating mayor and council that your city is now hostage to the Cold War because you're really a prime target for the Russians or anybody else. Who's in a position to make trouble. Your city is dead meat. And if you want to maximize or minimize your risk, maximize your safety factor, you want to put these missile silos on the downwind side of your Tucson.
Jeez.
Like closer to the Gila country.
Oh, gosh.
So there was a hue and cry out of Wilcox and Benson and the downwinders.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, this is a little tangent off where we were.
Yeah, well, are we, we're still in Montreal, technically.
We're still in Montreal.
Right. Right. We haven't yet come to Tucson.
We haven't yet come to
right.
Tucson.
Right. That was just a little diversion.
Well, you asked where
Gaylord
Overkill
Simpson
came from.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, it all started with George Gaylord Simpson.
Right.
So anyway, you
but
were
getting
in
back to Montreal right. in the snowy winter and
right.
and being bored counting pollen. The next thing that there were two other things that happened in going through Simpson's checklist. The next was fascinating and more of a surprise, and that was looking at the continents. The large animal extinction event hit hard in America, apparently in Australia, and obviously in Madagascar. That was already known in those days.
Just that Madagascar
that,
was...
large mammals, there were a lot of extinct lemurs out of Madagascar,
yeah.
The extinct hippo, the giant bird, although it wasn't in Simpson's checklist.
Mm-hmm.
And a strange anteater-like thing.
And it was known for Australia and the Americas too?
And large mammals in North and South America mm-hmm. were in the late, in the Pleistocene checklist.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't in Eurasia much at all. And not too heavy in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course all these large animals survived in Africa.
Right.
Although when you look at them up close, they aren't as big, like those attics we were looking at and those new gnu yesterday were not as large as the buffalo. On average, your African artiodactyls are scaled down a bit from what large mammals at the end of the Pleistocene are running for body weights in North America. That hasn't been quantified, but it's an impression.
Was that in your Nature paper? Your 66 or 68 Nature paper?
It should have been. I don't remember.
Yeah,
if it was.
Okay, I'll have to look.
So this is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have two kinds of continents. Continents where there's all hell breaking loose as far as large mammals go, and continents where things are more benign.
Mm-hmm.
And the latter are where people are evolving, and the former are where people are arriving. And then the clincher, which I hadn't—I kind of anticipated it for the West Indies, but I didn't know it was going to play out for other islands and other parts of the world—was that when you turn to islands, small animals are involved. Small mammals are taking hits in the Pleistocene on islands.
Right, and so it's not just a something about you don't need the large body size anymore now that the glaciers are gone.
Well, whatever the explanation might be that's driven by climate, the stuff that you're going to have to explain is what we're going over. You're going to have to explain the fact that the end of the Pleistocene has a lot of extinction, that this is a matter of large animals, that this happens more intensely in certain kinds of continents than others, and that small animals are involved, but only on oceanic islands.
Mm-hmm.
And small mammals can't get into the way offshore islands, so you can't get a record for them in the remote Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're within 600 miles of a continent like the Galapagos, or even closer in the case of the West Indies and the islands in the Mediterranean, you're losing stuff.
Right, and you were the first person to put all that data sort of together and wonder about it.
I was more hooked into it, I think, than it had been mentioned. The idea that people were important in extinctions had been mentioned by Colbert in the 1930s. Ned Colbert, the guy who's still alive and working on dinosaurs.
He's still alive?
Yeah. Up in Flagstaff.
Wow.
I don't know. He must
okay.
be 100 years old.
Yeah,
I don't know.
At least. Yeah.
Well, maybe he was in his 20s
yeah.
when he was publishing about about the possibility of people being involved in. So some of the vert paleo people were mentioning it as a possibility, and the geographers like Carl Sauer were considering it. They also wanted people to arrive in the New World much earlier than Clovis. They were arguing that we discounted human potential to get into the New World much earlier, and that argument still goes. But nobody had done what I've just done, which is recite from a checklist how this might be defended or tested.
Right, and looking at the whole world, not just the
planet. Right, looking at the planet.
Right.
So that was the Montreal Chateauguay. It was the town we were out near.
And this was happening over the course of how long a time that you were?
That was over the course of a week or so.
So 1 week you started thinking that you're on.
It didn't take long to make the tables. Mm-hmm. Once you get into it, right, mm-hmm. time flies. All of a sudden,
okay.
a lot of time has been invested, but it didn't yeah. seem like much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and the Pliocene and the Miocene rates, this is a fourth aspect that follows. It's a little harder to verbalize, but to comparing the Pleistocene rates and assuming that the Pleistocene was a million years in length, and assuming, and this is a wild assumption, that your samples are more or less equivalent in their variance, and they're not. You're going to compare the Pliocene to the Pleistocene. Well, the Pliocene probably isn't known nearly as well as the Pleistocene.
Mm-hmm.
But in the comparisons, making some estimates of the time duration for Miocene, Pliocene, and Pleistocene, and looking at animals that suffered heavy extinction, like the mammoths and the proboscidea, at the end of the Cenozoic, at the Pleistocene, and dividing by the elapsed time for those extinctions to occur, one would get a curve in which the data points for the Miocene and the Pliocene were close to baseline, and the data point for the Quaternary or the Pleistocene was way up in the air.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the same week you were doing that too?
Maybe a month. I don't know.
Right. And what year
days,
was that?
Days, months, weeks.
Yeah.
It was all 1956.
This was 56? Wow.
The winter of 56, the spring of 57.
So it then took you, what, the Nature paper was 66? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Nature paper.
Yeah.
It took you 10 years to publish.
Yeah, because I'm trained to do fossil pollen analysis. I wanted to give up herpetology. I wanted to do fossil pollen. I didn't want to theorize about vertebrate extinctions. I didn't know what a humerus of a mammoth might look like compared to a humerus uh-huh. of a Lipdetern. I couldn't have told them apart,
uh-huh.
much less their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not in touch with the vert paleo people to see what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at this as a biogeographer who's dealing with modern distributions and a pollen analyst who's getting into the fossil record through pollen grains and sediments. And I'm going to try to sell this to Arizona so I can get out of Montreal.
So you weren't racing to publish this idea at all?
I had to find something to add to the Pleistocene biogeography paper that I was invited to submit to Zoogeography.
Okay.
One of these, give the young folks a chance to publish early, invite them into your symposia.
Mm. Now, what stimulated you to finally write your Nature paper? Why did that happen?
Let me say one more thing about the curves.
Okay.
Because we haven't said what happens to the rabbits.
Okay.
We talked about the elephants.
Right.
When you take the extinction of the rabbits in the Pleistocene and divide it by time, it's also almost on baseline. So, or maybe even it's lower than rabbit extinction in the Miocene.
Okay.
So you have a curve that's going in the opposite direction from the one that you're looking at for Pleistocene extinctions for large animals. Large animals are suffering heavy extinction at the end, and the curve shows that for order by order, where you're looking at only large mammals in the order.
And you talk this, your 100-pound, 44 kilograms.
Yeah, somewhere.
You came up with then?
I don't know where I came up with that, but I thought it was intuitively useful to think of a large as our size or more so.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a person might have a pretty good visual image of what 100 pounds is, even if they didn't know metric scale. They could be
right.
told that 44 kilograms or 45 kilograms is about 100 pounds.
Right.
Then they've got it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it isn't very sophisticated because it should probably be logged, and you go starting with grams. Run up every 10 grams to log it that way.
Now, why were rabbits so significant to you? Because
they were almost large, but not quite. They were definitely under 44 kilograms.
Right.
There's no known fossil mega rabbit. Or if there is, maybe we'll find it in the look at the tertiary record.
Yeah.
This is a check on what's going on. I didn't know all the weights of things, so I might have made some assumptions. That was another thing I had to worry about. If I had a sophisticated weight scale, then I'd have to know how you convert a bone of a certain size to an estimate of its mass. And people do that and spend lifetimes learning how to do that, and I had to find a shortcut. So the small mammals are not showing a Pleistocene peak by order. Then you can work a little bit in the fine-tuning area, like the carnivores divide into large and small. Carnivores can be on both sides of the 44 kilogram boundary, and you can see how their curve looks, and you compare freshwater to marine carnivores, the seals and the dolphins and
right,
so forth.
Right, right, right. Okay.
And then you go to the whales. Well, here you're in a bunch of big animals. They've got a good fossil record. They don't show any Pleistocene blip. They've got more extinction in the Miocene, even divided by time, than the Pliocene, than in the Pleistocene. In fact, the latest checklist on whales shows very little extinction in the Pleistocene, the most up-to-date 1997 effort at doing the same thing that Simpson was doing. So I thought that was pretty powerful. If I'd been a better advocate in art, better lawyer, I could have had this thing all over by 1965.
What you did then is you just published this chapter, and then what finally stimulated you to decide to go for nature and by yourself?
Well, the trip to Africa and the tourist tripping through the game parks and visiting Olduvai with Louis Leakey. Going to Madagascar with Alan Walker.
It was part of the same trip?
Part of the same 5 months trip. Nobody had gone from Africa to Madagascar before looking at this stuff.
Ooh.
I really wanted to see this personally. If I didn't know the paleontology well, at least I wanted to know the living fauna.
Yeah, yeah.
And see the game park realities.
Yeah.
In Africa. But people working in Africa had their hands full. And very few people were working in Madagascar who were Caucasians. Well, or anything. The French had been there, but they were not doing much at the time. They were doing some good stuff, getting some radiocarbon dates. There was a geographer, Battistini, that was mapping a beach in southern Madagascar that he called the Epiornian Formation for the giant bird Epiornis, because the beach had was characterized by eggshells, extinct bird.
Wow, wow. So when you went over there, did you have in your mind that you wanted to do another major paper? Or you were just this was a continuing curiosity of yours?
Well, I was trained to think that you should publish on good stuff.
Okay, so you were thinking you might get some stuff here that
I was ego-driven without a doubt.
And you were thinking of nature. I'm going to go there.
The Quakers also publish.
Okay. So that was, this was all part, and then you came back and you wrote up your nature paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I send a copy to Louis Leakey, and he hated it. He thought it was rotten.
I know you've got him in the acknowledgments. He didn't want to believe that people could do nasty things like that.
Well, he didn't want to believe that something important would happen. This is purely my opinion. That something important would happen in his backyard that he didn't already know a lot about.
Oh.
And he had not written about extinctions in Africa being caused by evolving hominids as a model to consider. I didn't know what a model was in those days. I thought they were more enlightened, like the hypothesis or something, theory. But the idea that you could consider a variety of wild choices and the more variable the better. If it hadn't happened, if Louis Leakey didn't have his hand on it, he was a control freak. He was not thrilled.
And you went ahead anyway. This did not intimidate you.
Well, I had a continent and an ocean separating us once I'd gotten out of Africa, and I didn't plan to go back again right away. But people who did, who wanted to do field work on stratigraphy in Africa, had been told, never got a chance to go back once they'd crossed swords with Louis Leakey.
Yeah.
I tried to lure him in. I tried to send him a copy of the manuscript in advance.
Yeah.
We talked about it.
Yeah.
And he was wonderful to travel with because he was both skilled and he was wily. He knew exactly how to point things out to somebody who was green and new to the place at a time when they could. That snake that we saw on the road, Louis Leakey would have pretended that he'd taken you there because he knew that snake was going to be there.
Oh, the great master.
And for Louis Leakey, the snake might have cooperated every time Leakey came along with a truckload of visitors. The snake would come out and be in the bush. He claimed that he could see the snake in a bush from 100 feet out or something like that. Do you see that snake? Apparently it was some kind of vine snake that did regularly park in a bush on the way that he was driving people to Olduvai Gorge. But you never knew when he was pulling your leg and when it was for real. He'd also show you places that were gouged by elephant trunks to get salt around Olduvai Gorge, and that everybody knows about that who's got experience at Olduvai. Newcomers need to be shown that, because otherwise it just looks like somebody was digging there with a shovel.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, what about peer review? Did you have trouble with peer review in nature?
Not a bit.
Really?
Not a bit. Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Nature wasn't as high-flying in those days. Nature was looking for new stuff. The more outrageous, the better. They published Leakey's reply, which was taking me to task, but he had only nits to pick. I'd misspelled some stuff. I'd forgotten some animals that should have been included, and I'd included a few that shouldn't have been in the argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I published a version of the global extinction paper in Natural History, and he wrote a letter to Natural History, too.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was winning the battle at that point, because if the big guy is writing pissy stuff like letters to the journal that you published, the bigger paper,
it
you've got them.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry
you.
About them.
So you had a personality, despite being a Quaker. You had a personality.
I'm not a Quaker. I'm a half Quaker.
Okay. Okay. Despite being a half Quaker, you had a personality where you weren't going to let this be daunting at all when the big guys jumped on you.
Well, at the time, I was a lot younger. I hate to be jumped on by big guys. I really don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have much temper to take much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm ambitious, and I'm driven by the elephant child's curiosity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I've got a hook.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that after I publish in Nature, everybody will agree and it'll all be over and there won't be any more argument.
Ha.
I did not think there was going to be 30 years of futzing around with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, think about Darwin's origin. It kind of went, for a while.
Well, maybe it's more important than I've given it credit. I don't know.
Now,
maybe that's a measure of the fact that this is something important.
Right.
The fact that people are so unwilling to just say, oh, ho-hum, oh yes, and go on to other stuff.
True. Because actually that would be rather depressing. Once it gets to the point where it becomes just standard, well, how could anyone not think that way?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the bring back idea comes out of it, but from the sounds of it, when Larry Agenbrough, when we were talking about it, he was mentioning you were first into bringing back camels.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about how your bring back idea came on, this whole, the idea of...
Yeah, that happens almost simultaneously with the model or the hypothesis that people are driving the extinctions. And given that, and given our impulses for restoration ecology, it seems like it's on our watch that the responsibility not to cause any more extinctions looms large, but also to remedy as best we can what we think has gone awry. And if camels were particularly interesting because they're arid land adapted, there was a lot of interest at the time through a program in measuring productivity that was being funded by interagency groups. The idea of understanding more about energy flow and ways to capture more productivity was going to be contributing to.
What year about was this?
Oh, this would be 60s somewhere, early 70s. I think it's still in the 60s. The IBP, the International Biological Program.
Did you heard of that?
Well, yeah, I knew it was sort of a coming on of this idea of modeling energy flows. And
this was the days when people were saying things like,
there
will no more be need for journals because everything will be online.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be no more need to subscribe because you'll... And there'll be no more delay between writing and publishing because peer review won't be necessary.
Uh-huh.
Jeez.
But anyway... modeling is coming forward, and those of us who were trained in the more classical ways were having to scrabble around some to varying degrees with varying degrees of success at getting on board. Because those who weren't on board were going to have to do a lot of good stuff if they weren't going to do modeling.
So the camels with the idea that grazing might help productivity, is that...
Yeah, well, the article that got into Natural History on searching for 40 million animal units of new protein was based on the fact that the desert creosote bush, the desert species we've got outside the window here, don't have any large herbivores that they can support. And part of that is because their annual biomass production is low. But part of it is perhaps because the large animals that would have consumed that biomass are gone. Mm-hmm. And the domestic animals we're bringing back as substitutes, as proxies, aren't really well designed to eat creosote bush. It's a dominant species, as you know. And it does have a net annual yield. Maybe it's a tenth of what you would get off of a good grassland, but then there's a vast area of it. So. Could you design a system that would, without destroying the creosote bush, take out an honest 5% or 10% a year of the annual production? Could you manage with browsers the way on a shrubland, the way you manage with grazers on a grassland?
Well, were you getting some grants for
no?
For this? You were just
no.
Following through on your own interest.
I got some grants to do radiocarbon dating on ground sloth extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I got some NSF support
mm-hmm.
to do research on extinction.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to join the International Biological Program people and drop the paleoecology.
Mm.
This was just a show and tell.
So what was your first venue for either orally or in print suggesting bringing camels back into the Southwest?
I think I wrote a thing for an Arid Lands newsletter called Empty Niches by the Old Corral.
Wow, that's a great title.
Yeah, that's good.
Right. That wasn't the one I used for Natural History a couple of years later. But I thought I better try this on a small scale first.
And what was the reception?
Harmless. Some people who are really interested in what you're doing if you're outrageous aren't going to come around and tell you that. They're back there waiting for more or doing their spin.
Mm-hmm.
But the Greek chorus doesn't come around if somebody thinks they ought to have one. They're not going to get one, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here the advantage, I think, of my being in this place, up here at the Desert Laboratory, was so nourishing and supportive. That was the peer group support that I had. I didn't have to day by day worry about some damn sedimentologist next door or some geotectonic wizard across the hall that I had to interact collegially with all the time. And then they'd be asking me, what the hell are you doing? And I'd be saying, well, I'm trying to model camels eating creosote bush.
Yeah, yeah.
That would stretch their collegial interests and certainly my skills in collegial communication to people whose departmental identity was honestly derived, and I'm kind of a carpetbagger as an ecologist in a geology department.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tyler's got the same thing now in the biology department.
Yeah, it sounds that way.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you did your camel thing early on, and then you dropped it for a while? Kind of, it was, you weren't publishing or talking about it much, and then the elephants came on recently.
Well,
is that how it goes?
Things kept coming on, and students started generating opportunities. There was always the constraint that the community of students I'm dealing with don't have much funding, none to start with, but they have the whole damn Sonoran Desert outside the door,
yeah,
and the fossil pack rat midden record in the early 60s. We'd had we'd had samples of pack rat shit from Rampart Cave and had identified extra local plants in it, like juniper, and we could have published it. I mean, I think I had tremendous good luck at skimming cream left and right, but missed cold turkey on skimming the initial pack rat stuff, even though it has been right here in the lab. We worked on the pollen and the radiocarbon dating and a little bit of geochemistry with Bruno Sables, but Phil Wells and the guy from BYU, his co-author, went to Science with a major paper in the 1960s, years after we'd been looking at some middens from Rampart Cave.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do everything.
No?
But okay, now bring back.
Some self kicks on that.
Right, now bring back with the elephants. When did you, I mean, when you were working on camels and thinking about them, did it ever cross your mind that you might eventually want to advocate bringing back elephants?
No.
Okay.
No.
When did that happen?
No, because I knew elephants were immigrants, and I wanted to stay away from orders of animals that had come into the New World rather than evolved here,
and then just
like the horses and the camels and the South American ground sloths and so forth.
Right.
And I didn't think of elephants. The little stuff I'd done in Africa hadn't been enough to get the idea that...
Hi.
Hi, Emmy.
You guys have a good time?
We're on candid camera, Emmy.
Yeah.
You're on candid camera?
Yeah. I'm recording an interview with him. No, we had a great time.
We had a great trip.
You recorded an interview with me after so I can correct what he said.
But yeah, it was great.
Yeah. And we survived.
Well, that's good. Did you get rain? It was so much rain up here.
Justin crossing the border at Nogales, coming back. That was all.
So I mean, this is great. So you really wanted to stay with the New World. I mean, we're talking family and order level endemic to this area and then spreading elsewhere.
Right.
That's great.
And a lot of effort to put together quaternary extinctions, trying to lure in the vertebrate. Well, it started with Pleistocene extinctions, and I thought I'll bring this same lot back again as best I can. And then more came in, and I kept trying to go to people who had solid knowledge of the Pleistocene or tertiary faunas of mammals in various parts of the world, or maybe faunas like New Zealand, and put it all together so that same experience I had in dealing with Simpson in the farmhouse in Montreal could be documented in detail by authorities from various corners of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was sure in the process of doing that, that people who were already disposed to reckon with climate as the explanation for what happened would begin to change their minds. There would be a paradigm shift. And there wasn't. People who came in with a tilt toward anthropogenic extinctions went out with that tilt. And those who came in with a tilt toward climate as the explanations would write their chapters, interact with the other authors, and go out with the same opinion. So I think there was some leaky style passion in back of this, or whatever the reason for getting committed to an interpretive mode to the degree that people wouldn't be fluid enough to move out of it later on. Or maybe it's just the quality of evidence that people deal with if they work with bones and they see Pleistocene faunas, and the extinctions are always happening when small mammals are doing things that they don't do later on. They'll say these small mammals are evidence that stuff is happening that's strange and weird, and that's climate driven, because they're certainly not affected by, they're not by any human activity. We can imagine the mice are shifting their ranges and overlapping in a way that reflects the power of the climate change. We don't know exactly what the details are, but the large ones are taking a big hit from climate change too. And this model has worked so long, and so many people have written that way, that the shift is too big for us to futz around with just because some biogeographer says people did it.
Right. It wants to bring in Madagascar. I mean, come on. We're just talking about the world.
We aren't dealing with Madagascar. Right. We're dealing with what we really know here in Texas and New Mexico, right, out of the University of Texas.
Yeah, so it's a complex data record, and they're finding correlations to something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could understand that would happen.
So I'm not worried about bringing back mammoths. I'm satisfied I'm making enough trouble. I can't understand why I'm making it, but
yeah.
I know it's trouble, and I'm not seeing people jump ship and come over and row in my little boat. And, people will start in on this, and some will sit in the middle and argue both ways, like Vance Haines thinks people do have a role, an important role to play in it, but he also has his Clovis drought right when the extinctions occur, and that he regards as a physical property. Middle of the roaders are there. Some people, I think, are there because they're craven, and that's a safer place to be.
Mm-hmm.
But Vance is not one of those. He's a tiger, and he'd be all out for one or the other if it suited him. I don't know. It's hard to know what people really do and why they do it. It looks as though sometimes you can guess what's going on. I don't know what Leakey was really into. I do think, however, Leakey was strongly driven by owning Africa and owning Kenya.
Yes. Yeah. Well, why did you put yourself out on the line to come up with the crazy idea of bring back the elephants? Or did you just assume that publishing in Wild Earth, no one will ever hear about it?
A little of that. Because you liked the thing I'd published before in Wild Earth, they wanted me to write something again. And we'd had some more conversations, and I knew I'd have one friend going into Wild Earth.
Yeah,
Bill Willers called out of the blue. That was after the piece had been written. And I thought, somebody who knows Africa ought to be in on this. And I forget how it was that I contacted Dave Burney. And he didn't immediately say, I've been waiting for your phone call.
It took a little while.
He thought it might be interesting. I said, here, you've been editing this draft I've written. You ought to be a co-author on this thing. And he wanted to hear a little more before he
isn't that the way it is with everyone? That there's no instant conversions on Rick
Back. I
mean, not with me, there wasn't.
Right.
And we've heard, you know, a lot of resistance.
Right.
Out there.
And I think there should be. I think it'd be really distracting and difficult to deal with if everybody suddenly jumped on Gaia and said, oh yeah, Lovelock's right and there's not much to it, but it's so simple, he happened to notice that it works this way, and now we all believe. It would kill any energy going into further discoveries.
Good point. Well, do you think ultimately much is going to happen with Bring Back? Do you think that?
I don't worry anymore.
Mm.
I don't think much ahead. I think more and more behind.
How so?
I'm not a front thinker. I'm not a front loader. I haven't had any luck so far guessing what people are going to do.
Wow.
I thought I could woo a bunch of vert paleo people that are good drinking buddies.
And
if I couldn't woo Don Grayson, like, there wasn't much hope because he's rational. And he's young, and he's well educated. He's a good interdisciplinary scientist.
Was that the results of some symposiums?
No, we didn't have a symposium before. We had one after. With some of the people in 85 here in Tucson.
You were gathering people to write.
But I wrote people. There'd never been a symposium from. Wait, that's not true. There was a symposium in advance of the 67 one.
67 one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But not for this one.
That was probably fairly interesting.
Nobody turned me down that I invited to contribute, with the exception of a few people that had written in the first book, and they didn't want to do it again. Didn't have anything new to say.
Well, okay, how does anachronisms, in your view, feed into these? I mean, anachronisms, it's a kind of peripheral thing from the other things that you've been doing, the overkill, but from my perspective, it's key. So how do you view anachronisms fits into the main trajectory of your career?
Oh, I'm still coattailing on Dan Jansen and on Connie Barlow now. if people who are, I'm not much beyond the magic of walking a trail and looking at it in a very low key sort of way. You're touching on experiments. You're constantly running into places where you want to feed animals different kinds of things.
Yeah.
You'll get into experimental designs if you keep going that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that.
It's a side tangent. I love it.
Right.
But, I don't want to pretend to see much for me to do in that area. I think it is. It is at a point now that people. That exchange between Howe and Jansen is an example of the level of investment that somebody needs to make if they're going to publish in scholarly journals at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, like that South American crew that we were emailing with for a while. You know, they had a conference down there. I went to their website where they had a conference on fruit dispersal down there. They had nothing dealing with anachronisms. There was no aspect
uh-huh.
there.
Uh-huh.
I was really amazed about that.
Uh-huh.
Nothing.
No, that's the edge of the cliff. That's where temper probably makes a huge difference in approach to science.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this what the temper means, but
yeah.
if you haven't some fantasy life going about the dimensions of the subject you're looking at, you aren't going to do any research in that direction.
Right. Well. Before Jansen contacted you, I mean, he was, you're mentioned his Perse Com and his ecology duet papers, 1981, on the horse enterobium experiment that he was doing. Before he was contacting you about these ideas and asking you what Pleistocene horse was around in those days, had any of this perspective occurred to you at all? I mean, you were already looking at landscapes as being very different if you have camels here browsing on creosote bush. But beyond the landscape level, had any of these mutualistic interactions?
I hadn't thought about Guanacaste or palm fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And I once I thought about those, then I looked back at the tropical stuff in Sonora. I had thought about mesquite beans.
Oh, you had?
A little bit.
Before Jansen contacted you?
Well, maybe not. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that would go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think I had, because I was thinking that burros are eating mesquite beans and horses and mules, and there probably were extinct Pleistocene horses that did the same, and that was the evolution of that bean pot.
Right. But you kind of stopped there. You didn't start asking what other fruits of the Americas might have been.
No.
That was Jansen who did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You might get some completely different answers if I find that file. There's a Janssen correspondence file.
Oh, really? Wow, that you still have accessible.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I saved it because I wanted to let you know about it at some point. I forget where the files are in the drawers.
No, because that would be great. That would really be great for me to look at. You know, sort of, what I've been able to find is that there are a few people who've been really excited by it and done some work in it. And there's a lot of other people kind of stumbling around who are working on particular animals or particular plant or particular animal plant. Wow. Oh, you've got these pictures.
I had an extra one of those.
Where did this come from anyway?
That came from Sykes. What's her first name? She wrote a book on elephants, and she had a photograph. And we had an artist make a copy, not a very good copy of her.
So in other words, you own the title to this.
I wrote to the publisher for rights to use it. Yeah.
Oh, so if I wanted to try to use something like this in my book, would that be possible for me to...
Don't see it'd be any problem.
Great. Could I wander off with...
You take that. There's an extra. There's another.
Yeah. No, that
there's
would be great.
Third.
Yeah, there's several in here.
Yeah, because this would be fine when it wouldn't be this big anyway. It'd be like,
right. It would... It would.
And a half by
that
six
would work
maximum,
just
so
fine. Yeah.
Fine, yeah.
So what book would I reference that where this was published in? Was it in here?
It's in the Wild Earth article, a reference to Sykes, I think.
Right, but where? But that was.
Well, let's
yeah.
see. It's definitely in Janssen Martin.
Okay. Okay. So what do we have in this file? Oh yeah. Okay. Permission to use as a base for your drawing an illustration which appears in our book, The Natural History of the African Elephant. Yeah. Now let me ask you this. Whoa. So Henry Howe gave you in advance his paper.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Dan. Okay, so this is 84. This is 2 years later. 2 years later, because this might be late correspondence of yours. 84, 84, 77?
It's not filed much. Just sort of smuck it in the focus.
Whoa! Dear Dan, what a fun letter and idea. I'll invoke the ghosts of some hungry extinct herbivores, and you will see if they eat up the fallen fruit. This is 77.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this letter?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't sound unfamiliar, but I don't remember letters or shit. Yeah, it's staggering when you.
Dear Paul, I've
reach
got a screwy
seniority
idea.
To look at what would have been hot and fresh at the time when it's cool and vague.
This is so great, this correspondence. Could I copy this somewhere? Is there a place here for me to make copies of this?
Yeah.
Because I mean, this
is the key one. Because that's really.
This is the one that generates this. This is the wait. Where is it?
It's in back of this.
Oh, it's in back of it. This
it's
is
in
the
text.
Dear Paul, I've got a screwy idea. How did he? This is 77. How did he know you at this point?
I think he'd succeeded me as book review editor for Ecology in the 10 years earlier. I don't remember how this correspondence started out, but I kind of like to do zany correspondence on occasion, and if people responded in kind or started out that way, I like to go that way.
This is key. This is the key paper.
So you'll copy that one?
Yeah, let me hold this out here. You have a copy machine right in this
building? Yeah, right around, just beyond in the main lab. Let me get a...
Let's see.
Somewhere there's a...